So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
I'll be walking through five things you should be able to tell your friend about Roe versus Wade today. My guest a little later on will be Jim O'Day, the Executive Director of Integrity Restored. We're going to be taking up a uncomfortable topic. Have you ever heard it said that you have to in order to stay healthy? We'll disprove this and explain why. Stay tuned. But if you didn't know, the nasty lat hat ladies are at it again this weekend. They're taking to the streets for the latest installment of the Women's March. I'll tell you exactly what we should expect, how we can respond to our friends and family members who want to walk with the nasty hats, and also, I'll be there at the march this weekend as well, gathering on the ground information from people about why they really are there and if they get what the Women's March stands for. We'll be diving into the philosophy of jiu-jitsu with Jim O'Day today. He is a seasoned jiu-jitsu professor, sensei. Do you call him sensei in jiu-jitsu? I don't think so. But we'll be talking about the way of the warrior and the philosophy behind it and how it relates to our Catholic faith. If you'd like to weigh in on the conversation today, head over to my Instagram story. You can find me at Timmerie. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. Send me a message or give me a call at 1-888-914-9149. I threw this question up, asking the question of what do you want to know about Roe versus Wade? And we're going to answer a few of those questions now, specifically pertaining to the Supreme Court decision of Roe versus Wade from 1973, which I'll give you five things that you should be able to communicate about it in just a little bit. If Roe versus Wade is brought to the table, here's the first question. Is it something that can be undone? Yes. This Supreme Court decision does not stand on solid science or even legal matters in this case. It was not a legitimate case, and I'll explain why in just a couple minutes. The case would not hold up in court, and this is why Planned Parenthood and pro-abortion advocates are terrified that if there's a shifting in the number of judges that would give a fair hearing to the Roe versus Wade case, that the science, the legal arguments would not stand. So what would happen if Roe versus Wade were overturned? Well, the decision of whether or not abortion is legal would actually go back to the states. Now, prior to Roe versus Wade, many, if not most of the states already had pro-life laws written into their state constitution or passed as a law. And so if Roe v. Wade is overturned, we're going to default and say, what was the prior status of the state prior to Roe versus Wade, or has a law or constitutional change been made with regard to the status of abortion? For example, this is why there was a major battle in 2019 when Roe was brought into question, because people knew that if Roe v. Wade was overturned, that we would turn to the states. And so New York, Illinois, and other states followed in the path of the state of California, making sure that it was written into the individual state constitution that there was unfettered access to abortion through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy. So if Roe v. Wade is overturned, it's written into that state constitution, and those will be, quote unquote, the safe spaces for women because they'll have access to abortion. So if the Roe v. Wade is overturned, what will the pro-life movement's next step be? We'll be taking it to the battleground of state to state, making sure that pro-life laws are a part of the state constitution. The legal requirements protecting the unborn will be fundamental, and we will stand on solid science and good legal arguments. Now, the question is, if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, how likely will it be that Roe v. Wade is overturned? Well, it's a matter of having the right case come to the Supreme Court in order for the Supreme Court justices to take a good ponder, essentially, of the Roe v. Wade case. So it's a matter of what law makes it all the way, once it's brought into question, to the Supreme Court justices. The thing is that with Amy Coney Barrett on the court, along with some of the other most recent judges, we're playing a numbers game that will give a much higher likelihood that the judges will fairly call into question the validity of the original Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton cases from 1973. Now, the question is, a good book that details the Roe v. Wade case recently released. It's by Dr. Hilgers, and it's titled The Fake and Deceptive Science Behind Roe versus Wade. I highly recommend it. I have a copy of it with me now. I'm going through it, and we'll have Dr. Hilgers on the show here very soon. So quickly, I want to run through with you five things you should be able to tell your friend about Roe versus Wade. Number one, Roe versus Wade made abortion legal through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy. Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton were decided on the same day in 1973. Through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy, the same day she could be giving birth, she could decide as she's giving birth that she wants to have an abortion. And legally, that is allowed because of Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton. Number two, abortion is made on demand for any reason because of Roe v. Wade. There is no legal protection for a baby. In fact, some states may have laws that they've passed protecting a baby, say once a heartbeat is detectable or at a certain gestational age. But the problem is Roe versus Wade is federal law. And so if someone pushes hard enough to still obtain access for an abortion, it's a very strong likelihood that they will obtain access. The thing is that when local laws limit abortions, the likelihood of a woman knowing that she can push for that access or even trying to do so decreases, because the further out that abortion decision is made, the less likely she is to also have that abortion. Now, abortion was made on demand for any reason with no legal protection for the baby, like I said, but this is how bad it was. One of the justices, Justice Blackmun, claimed that we, as in the justices, were unable to arrive at a consensus of when life begins. I'm sorry, but that's outright relativism. You defining reality and rather than allowing science to answer the question. The court justices should not define when life begins. They should be applying the Constitution as it's meant to be applied. This is the difference with our court justices that we are seeing on the court today. They are not running with an agenda, but we're looking toward constitutionalists who are going to follow the Constitution that really does seek to protect the human person. Number three of five things you should be able to tell your friend about Roe versus Wade. In Roe versus Wade itself, it's actually documented that Roe v. Wade can't be called into question for one intriguing fact. And that is that if a pregnant woman is murdered, let's say by her husband, and the baby dies too, and he's convicted for a double homicide. Well, the fact that he's convicted for a double homicide is no reason to call into question the validity of Roe versus Wade. Isn't that fascinating? So in fact, up until recently, pretty much any state, if a man were to murder a woman who was pregnant, he would be responsible for killing two people if the baby dies too. But fascinatingly, back in 2019, after they wrote into their state constitution that abortion is legal through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy, there was actually a case that was in the works, and the man was in trouble for having killed a woman and a child. Well, because of the New York law making abortion on demand, they actually removed the homicide for the baby in utero. Very, very sad to see. Number four, the five things you should be able to tell your friend about Roe versus Wade. This court case was based on false evidence. I'll name just a couple things. It was a lack of proper legal scholarship. There was an extraordinary pro-abortion bias. And in fact, the case itself didn't stand on strong medical science. It actually appealed to pre-medieval science regarding pregnancy from hundreds of years ago. And I can just give you one example. They talked a lot about lowering the mother mortality rate? Well, penicillin has done more to reduce the mortality rate of women because it's helped to reduce infection during pregnancy. In addition to this false case and bad evidence, women were not dying in droves from abortion. That was a lie. And to prove that, just to discuss a little further, some homework for you, my fifth point in the five things you should be able to tell your friend about Roe versus Wade is this. Dr. Bernard Nathanson, one of the key persons providing information for the Roe versus Wade case, ended up claiming that most of the evidence given about women's mortality rate, number of abortions being performed prior to Roe v. Wade, were actually fabricated. They were a lie. He has converted to Catholicism and fought for many years for the right to the life of the baby and for the impact, for people to know the impact that abortion has on women. In addition to that, Roe, the woman of in the court case of Roe versus Wade, her real name is Norma McCorvey. She too converted to Catholicism and spent the rest of her life telling the truth about her involvement in Roe v. Wade, how she was manipulated, and she advocated for babies and mothers who had been hurt by abortion. Those are just five things you should be able to know and communicate about Roe versus Wade in this very important case that's being called into question. You're listening to Trending with Timory. My guest today is the executive director of Integrity Restored, Jim O'Day. They work to help restore integrity for those impacted by pornography. You can find them at integrityrestored.com. Now, Jim O'Day has an impressive resume prior to running Integrity Restored, including work in Homeland Security, defense, executive management, and much more. But he's also known for being a teacher of martial arts, in particular, jiu-jitsu. And Jim, you and I have talked a lot about this behind the scenes. I would love to get your thoughts on the philosophy of jiu-jitsu and how it relates to our Catholic faith.
Thank you, Timory. So good to be with you, as always. So yeah, we're going to talk tonight a little bit about a concept called Bushido, which is the way of the warrior. And it was either seven or eight tenets that the samurai would follow. It's interesting when you think about samurai, you probably think of these really violent guys, right? These kind of soldiers and these masks and helmets and but the word samurai actually means one who serves. So I think it's really an interesting concept for us to ponder, particularly as men, husbands, fathers, to be that kind of warrior, that warrior who serves. And so if you're going to do that, you need these tenets, which sound very much to me like Catholic virtues.
Let's walk through these. So how does it relate to our faith and these various tenets that are a part of the Bushido, the way of the warrior, the person who serves?
So first one is justice, and that is the strongest of all. That is one of the most important. And the way it would be defined in samurai times was, this is one's power to decide upon a course of conduct with reason, never wavering, even if there is great cost.
So ultimately finding truth in standing exactly within that center part of reason and not compromising in any way.
Never compromising, even at great personal cost to yourself.
This reminds me of the idea of fortitude, acting in the face of fear, even to the point of death. Isn't that what a warrior does?
Absolutely. And samurai were willing to die. Absolutely. That was part of their, you know, what they signed up for. There was no fear of death, as long as it was a good death, an honorable death, a death with justice.
So tell me a little bit about compassion and how this is a fundamental element of the way of the warrior.
Yeah, that's such an interesting one. They define it in Japanese as benevolence, would be the closest English translation. But it's really having love, affection, mercy, sympathy for others. And according to the samurai, This is the highest requirement for leadership. Not your toughness, not what you did on the battlefield, but were you benevolent? Did you have compassion? Could you exhibit mercy? What a dichotomy, right? From what we think.
Right, a warrior is. But you
but,
know what's
but how true as a dad,
yeah,
how true yeah. as a husband, you are the strongest when you have mercy.
Right. You know, it's interesting you bring up the word benevolence as part of that way of the warrior, that you essentially have to be someone who's compassionate, right? And I think of that study that came out a couple of years ago about how even radically pro-abortion feminist women who believe there are no differences between men and women still wanted to marry a benevolent sexist, as they put it, someone who actually believed there were differences between men and women, and so kind of put women up on that pedestal. Even if their ideology was different, they wanted to be treated like that.
Of course, it's a normal human desire, I think. And you got to think, now this goes back to a really violent time thousands of years ago, and yet that's where they put the most focus on for selecting a leader. Interesting.
How about the pillar of integrity? How is this fundamental to the way of the warrior?
Yeah, and so this is a really interesting one, because to them, integrity meant a couple different things. It meant courtesy and good manners at all times in all settings. And it also meant that your word must always be as good as your actions. Otherwise, one of the sayings was, otherwise you are an empty form. In other words, it's telling you, you're worthless.
So a man of honor, no matter what.
You keep your word, even if it hurts you, even if it costs you, even if it's hard, because that is how you grow in integrity.
It's really reliability. And isn't that what's so difficult right now in our culture? Is we're not reliable people. We don't commit. And then when we do, we kind of beat around the bush about it and we don't show up.
So one of the interesting things, an article I read some years ago, was talking about how we've lost integrity and honor in the business world. Because if a competitor comes along and offers us $5,000 more a year salary, we're gone. Which brings us to another tenet of Bushido, which is loyalty. To understand your indebtedness. That's a really cool definition that they had.
Understand your indebtedness. That is an awesome way to explain loyalty. So it has to do with responsibility, what's been bestowed upon you, but what you've committed to.
Well, and I just, when I think about that, I think about it in so many different ways, right? I think about it in our indebtedness to the Lord, right? To be loyal
right.
to Him,
yeah.
To our families, to our parents, to our employers, to our community, to, wow, you can just expand and expand and expand that definition. And particularly as men, I think if we learned that and practiced it, totally different world.
Would you say that that loyalty to understand your indebtedness would be rooted in gratitude, because it helps you to understand the gifts you've been given, especially foremost from God?
Amen. Absolutely. I think that's where it all starts. And then if you have that virtue of gratitude, what a great way to live your life. Takes a lot of the pressure off. And it's so interesting when we think of these martial concepts of Bushido, but how do they apply in everyday life? And the correlation's there.
We mentioned courage a little bit at the beginning of breaking down the way of the warrior and the various pillars, but explain a little bit more of courage.
Courage is an interesting one, because they said bravery is for children. But courage can only be counted as virtuous if it's exercised with justice and righteousness, despite the risk or danger.
Explain that a little bit more. Break it down.
So to me, when I've been teaching this for 30 years and talking about it with my students, to me, bravery is you rush in. You see something happening, you rush in, you don't give it much thought. Still a good thing, and it's brave, but courage is you know what's going to happen when you go in there, or what could happen, but you go anyway. Because it's protecting your family, or it's protecting someone weaker than you, or it's standing up for something that has to be stood up for, and it's going to cost you personally. That's courage.
So knowing it's a sense of justice and knowing the consequences that will come.
And doing it anyway.
It's That's interesting courage. Because the church talks a lot about how in order to be counted as a martyr, a person who dies for the faith has to choose to die for the faith. Someone can't just, you know, knock you off and say, oh, I'm killing you because you're Catholic. The person who is dying in order to be considered a martyr has to say, yes, I accept my death because I know and understand the sense of justice and my responsibility and the consequences for having stood for my faith.
That's a high bar.
Right.
That's a very high bar.
That's why the church is very slow to call someone a martyr.
Makes sense. Yeah. I never knew that definition. But it goes to this courage thing too, right? That's their definition between bravery and courage. You have to know it.
Ooh, three more to go. Respect, honor, and self-control. We'll come back in wrapping up these three pillars of the way of the warrior. And we'll also answer that question of whether or not is it necessary in order to stay healthy. I'll be right back with my guest, Jim O'Day from Integrity Restored.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
My guest is Jim O'Day, Executive Director of Integrity Restored. You can find him at integrityrestored.com. They're helping people who are struggling with a pornography addiction to be healed from those wounds. But Jim also has the experience of teaching jiu-jitsu for a number of years now. And we're talking about Bushido. It's the way of the warrior and the pillars of a warrior, one who serves. We have three pillars to go: respect, honor, and self-control. Jim, let's break down these three last pillars.
Sure. So respect is interesting because it has a two-part definition according to the Code of the Samurai. The first is dealing justly with others because it is the honorable thing to do. So outward respect, respecting your dealings with people. The other definition is showing strength when the going gets tough. That's how people are going to respect you. So they look at it from two ways, the external and then the personal. The next one, honor, is also very interesting. They define it as a strong sense of dignity and self-worth by doing what is right. That is how you grow in dignity and self-worth, by always doing what is right. The final one, self-control, this is the one that just always blows me away. A man should always behave according to an absolute moral standard. What is right is right. What is wrong is wrong. And your most important job as a father is to teach your children those moral standards that transcend logic through the model of your own behavior. That is from the code. That is what Bushido teaches.
I love this. If you weren't able to catch all of those rules for the life of the warrior, I really want to encourage you to go back. You can listen to this podcast by heading over to relevantradio.com/trending. Again, my guest is Jim O'Day, the Executive Director of Integrity Restored, a seasoned jiu-jitsu professor. Do we call you professor? What's the official word?
Sensei. Sensei.
Oh, you're a
is
sensei.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes,
I was
sensei
right.
is correct. So, sensei
I thought that
in
was
Japanese.
Just karate.
No, sensei in Japanese means teacher.
Okay.
And many of the martial arts have accepted that term. And then shihan means master teacher. So when you get to 6th, 7th degree rank, then you're a shihan.
You're listening to Trending with Timory. That's a Jim O'Day. A very common question brought up in our culture, especially over the last 20 years, is celibacy or abstinence unhealthy for me? In fact, there's this huge push from the medical community, even encouraging young children, along with adults of all ages, that you need to engage in physical self-touch in order to remain healthy. And there are statistics that are thrown out there claiming that 80 to 90% of men engage in such conduct, even those people we would say consider most honorable, even our clergy. And so some of these claims are thrown out there. And Jim, I know you working a lot with the issue of pornography and various addictions. And again, little ears warning if you're listening here. I'd like to get your thoughts on this claim. Is it harmful for us to engage in celibacy or abstinence?
No, not at all. And it's interesting to follow up the Bushido conversation with this one. Because, again, going back thousands of years into the samurai culture, they would not have relations before major battles or contests. We hear from sports celebrities all the time about not
yes.
doing that before.
Right.
The Taoists in China actually believe it lowers a man's overall strength.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's the saying? Don't go for a hard workout the next day for men, right?
No, exactly right. So there's physical, chemical, emotional reasons. Look, self-touch or relations with your partner, it's an incredibly complicated and deep act. It's affecting your emotional state, your brain chemistry, your hormones. But there's no proven reason that I've found that would say you're unhealthy if you don't do it. In fact, abstinence today, with the explosion of STDs in our culture, is a really safe way to keep yourself healthy. Be abstinent. And if we talk about abstinence from self-touch, there's a lot of benefits to it. We just talked about self-control, mastery, clarity of your mind, self-knowledge, being able to have deeper relationships outside of just the physical with people, but to really connect on an emotional level, to focus more on your work because that's not the only thing on your mind. Actually, and the most of the medical articles you'll read, Timory, will say that having a good time by yourself lowers your stress. But actually, it doesn't. It's a real momentary dip, and then your stress spikes back up. Mm-hmm. When you stop behaving in that way for a certain period of time, actually as short as 10 to 20 days, your body starts to learn, oh, I don't need that little drop in stress. I need a big drop in stress.
Mm-hmm.
And so it starts to produce the relaxation chemicals because it's not being fooled anymore.
And that also doesn't even take into consideration, you know, a momentary pleasure doesn't touch on the long-term impact. For example, I could indulge in 10 bags of Cheetos in a couple minutes here during the break. It might make me feel great at the moment, but I might have a horrible stomach ache, gain a ton of weight. I might be struggling with mental fog then. And so there are physical consequences for engaging that. We're seeing people are struggling with ED dysfunction, right? We're seeing this very, very common. I mean, go to any sports channel. That's one of the most common advertisements that we hear anymore. And so not only the fact that many men, and you can speak to this if you would, Jim, struggle with that self-criticism and feeling just terrible about themselves after.
Well, and that's one of the big challenges. There are two. Your listeners can go and look this up. The way that God made us is so perfect and so incredible, and medical science doesn't get it. But when we're together with our partner, our married partner, we have a different response in our brain, and it's called a resolved response. It's everything is the way it's supposed to be. There is no shame and guilt afterwards. There's happiness and lightness and joy. When you're by yourself, on the other hand, it's unresolved. And so your dopamine crash is, they can show it to you on MRI machines. It's wow. A huge drop. Yeah, it's incredible. And one of the things that happens when we're stuck in that habit is that we stop looking at situations logically, because we're just constantly activating this kind of carnal primal area of our brain. Mm-hmm. And so when you stop that habit, just even as short as, you know, a month to 3 months, that area of your brain stops kind of challenging you, and you can look at all situations much more logically.
Mm-hmm. It's neat when you study neuroscience and the brain and how
it's even amazing.
If you look at the feeling, the emotional side of the brain that's responding to animal-like instincts, our desire for pleasure, that dopamine kick and that excitement building up. But then if you look at the thinking portion of the brain, it's almost like a cap that comes up and over the feeling brain to kind of say like, hey, stop and think. You are under reason. Like, you are under my control and should be. But we have to decide whether or not we're going to be there. And so the big question is celibacy or abstinence, or even should I say monogamy in marriage, unhealthy for us?
No, not at all. In fact, quite the opposite, right? So let's say you're a young guy and you want increased physical stamina. Be abstinent, because you're absolutely going to have an increase in free testosterone in your body. And you need that, right? In addition to the little blue pill you were talking about, that's one of the other commercials that's just bombarding television, that men's testosterone levels are too low.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of reasons for that, and we probably should do another show on that, because if you take water samples, the estrogen levels in the water samples are out of control from women yes. throwing away birth control pills and urinating out the right. excess chemicals. But we need testosterone as men. So stop giving it away. Mm-hmm. Stop throwing it away. You know, it improves your memory. It takes that thinking part of your brain that you were talking about and starts strengthening that. Mm-hmm. And here's a really basic benefit. Sorry,
tell
one
us.
More.
No, go
really
ahead.
Basic benefit. How about just being able to enjoy the good things in your life?
Mm-hmm. It's simple, right? Isn't it simple that it's holding that value for other people, their thoughts, their intentions, their time. But I think that sometimes this problem stems from a lack of self-esteem and value of ourselves. We live in a culture that just says, like, you're an animal. You can do whatever you want. You can define what is right and wrong. We're talking about this in relation to abortion, Roe v. Wade earlier. And so we're at the point where someone goes, well, I have no value. So I don't have to practice self-control or temperance. I shouldn't go for a run or lift some weights when I'm tempted. This is the challenge where we're saying, I'm not even capable of overcoming my base desires.
I think that's very true, and that's been a narrative that, you know, probably started in the 70s and has just gotten worse. But I think there's also a natural human condition that we have to remember when it comes to this topic. Mm-hmm. We can train ourselves to use that as our self-soothing mechanism. And that's where you got to break the habit. Because that's relying on something that is not really soothing you.
Yeah. And it's not addressing
the problem. Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah. Just as pornography. Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. The same way. So this is the benefit when we understand that A, sex belongs in marriage with one partner. We have a greater value for ourselves and value for the other person. We understand that there's a complementarity rather than a self-objectification or an objectification of another person. And we can't continue to be fed that lie that to remain single, to be celibate, to be chaste and celibate for your entire life is harmful. No, actually, we're more than just the compilation of our body parts. We're a person who is meant to seek after good and who can accomplish great good through self-control, through choice, through reason, and ultimately through love. That's fundamental to who we are as a person.
Couldn't have said it better myself. That was beautiful. And that's what it comes down to, right? I think we've said it before on the show. Lust takes, love gives.
Amen. That's Jim O'Day from Integrity Restored. You can find him and his work at integrityrestored.com. They're helping people to heal and regain integrity after the impact of pornography. I'll be right back here on Trending with Timmery talking about the nasty hat ladies and how they're at it again this weekend. What should our response be and what should we expect? I'll be right back.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmery on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Didn't even know that, in fact, the women, the nasty hat ladies, are marching again. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to say that word on air. I'm just going there. I know there's a lot of words I probably say on air that you don't like. But these hats, I can't get over these hats. So I'll be interested if they're wearing the hats again at the Women's March. I'll be on the ground at one of the marches here in Southern California tomorrow, just asking people why they're there and if they really do understand what the pillars of the Women's March is. Because my take on it is that I think most women aren't deceived at the same level as they were back in 2017 about the Women's March. So many women truly thought that they were there wearing their pink, wearing their pro-women signs, many of whom were even pro-life. They didn't even realize that the Women's March was about abortion, LGBTQ rights, and contraception. They might have known, but not to the full extent. Now, over the last few years, the Women's March has had time to show what they stand for, with various social media campaigns and a lot of people having had conversations after the Women's March about what they saw, the speeches that were given, and how they felt about it. A lot more people today get that the Women's March stands for abortion, contraception, and LGBTQ rights, not women. And I say so-called rights. They stand for that. No differences between men and women. For the obliteration, in fact, of what marriage is between one man and one woman. I keep coming back to the fact that many people who attended the first 2017 march will not return because they have a better idea of the pillars behind the nasty hats. So when we look to the Women's March this go-around, I truly believe the numbers will be fewer. Many who are there will still be ignorant, but many will be the individuals who make up the march and the audience listening to the rallies of broken women who have been fed the lie that abortion and contraception are necessary to live, necessary to thrive, necessary to have an education, to have a career, to have a family on your own terms. It's going to be full of women who actually have had abortions and who are suffering from the wound of that abortion. So do you still have friends wanting to march? What should our response be to marchers? I'll answer that in just a moment here. Thank you for supporting Relevant Radio. It's our responsibility as Catholics, yours and mine, to be involved in the culture and the governance of our nation and community. Our church, family, and the most vulnerable members of society depend on it. Father Rocky's new ebook, Vote Your Conscience, will help you learn how to form your conscience around truth, beauty, goodness, and the Catholic teaching, and then to use your well-formed conscience in all areas of your life to make moral choices in voting, raising your family, and evangelizing those around you. Father Rocky's ebook is free. All you have to do is go to relevantradio.com/vote or sign up on the Relevant Radio app. After you download your copy of Vote Your Conscience, invite your family and friends to sign up and obtain their own copy. This knowledge is meant to be shared. Get your free copy of Vote Your Conscience today. Go to relevantradio.com/vote or sign up at Relevant Radio app right now. You're listening to Trending with Timory here on Relevant Radio. I've posed this question of whether we still have friends wanting to march, because I remember a few years ago, so many women wanted to participate in the Women's March because they are pro-woman. And when you say you don't support the Women's March, people thought, what are you thinking? Are you crazy? Are you not okay with women? Are you not okay with supporting women? And so the question's been brought up, what should our response be? How can I be a strong pro-life voice among pro-woman friends, pro-Women's March friends? I found that at this point, many of my friends, or even family members who wish they could have gone to the march, aren't saying that same thing this go-around. They have more important things to do as mothers, wives, responsible women in the community who see this march doesn't include me. So here's what our response should be to our friends and family who are pro-Women's March. Number one, we need to start by finding common ground on the big picture. Here's the reality. You and I are pro-woman too. Just because the lifestyle of a pro-woman looks a little different from what they're standing for doesn't mean that you are ill-equipped to respond or that you should be silenced. In addition to finding common ground, we need to change our attitude. And this could be with regard to any topic that we disagree with a friend, a stranger, a family member. The attitude needs to be coming from a place of love rather than just being right. Opening the doors to your ability to listen and find that common ground. I'm pro-woman too. We have to think about winning souls, not arguments, and this is what is so important. If we go into an argument, a tense situation, and it's about the other person, yes, what about what's right, but also helping the other person to get to what's right. Recognize you can't just smack them over the head with an encyclopedia and get them to know every single thing in that encyclopedia. We have to come from a place of love, charity. It's not about us being right. It's about the conversion of hearts, minds, and ultimately souls. Third, we have to listen and ask oversharing too many words. And this can be difficult, especially when we're nervous, especially when we want to have the right argument, the right response. We tend to overthink the conversation, replay it in our mind hundreds of times over after we've had it. And I'll touch on that a little bit more in a second. But if we really do listen and ask rather than spilling words out, it's going to change the dynamic of the conversation because it's going to make it focused on the other person who ultimately needs to come to the truth, to reality of the entire situation and what is good and what is not good. So we need to start by listening and asking questions. This is your tool to guide the conversation. You see, asking questions makes your friend break down their own mindset. This opens the door for the other person to see for themselves a faulty reason, lack of support for a position, or even a misguided good intention. I can't tell you how often just by asking questions about what the person said rather than posing my own arguments has actually led that person through their own defenses to back themselves into a corner where they actually feel uncomfortable. And when they're in that corner, it's just them. I'm not standing there. All I did was ask the question, and they're having to stand there with what they're claiming they believe that they've not fully thought through all the way. So this gives us the opportunity to speak to what they say and get this, compliment the good intentions they have, but then also purify their good intentions in the right direction. Again, it's about finding common ground, building the other person up so that they can do what is right. Remember, when we're talking to other people, we live in the midst of a generation, multiple generations, in fact, who have been unaffirmed, have grown up in broken homes, have been parented with reward parenting. The only way they view themselves as good is if they accomplish something great, rather than acknowledging they themselves are good. And so we need to compliment them as being good people, even if sometimes their intentions and the way they go about things aren't always. So as we are using this tactic of listening and asking rather than spilling many words, that means we also have to remember, don't spill all those words. There's a moment to stand up. I say this often, there's a moment to speak up, but there's also a moment to just shut up and sit down. This allows them to ask you questions or to sit uncomfortably with their thoughts. Think about it. Have you ever been in a debate when someone said something absolutely atrocious and you just didn't respond? Rather than immediately punching back or fighting or sharing your shock, sometimes silence can say a lot, especially when a very shocking statement is perhaps made devaluing the importance of that baby's life in the case of abortion, or in criticizing the necessity of men in the culture. Silence can be a powerful tool when used rightly, if we really are listening and tuning into the conversation, not just tuning into the next thing we want to say in response. You don't have to change a mind right away, but instead offer an open door for further dialogue. Remember, it's about planting seeds. It's about winning souls, not arguments, and that takes time. You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray. We're breaking down what our response should be to the women's marchers, people who disagree with us, to those people who say we shouldn't have a voice because we're pro-life and we're not pro-woman. Well, let's talk about some of the facts now. When you're in a conversation and we followed this approach of A, finding common ground, B, changing our attitude, coming from a place of love rather than being right, and three, listening and asking over throwing too many words out there. My fourth tip is this. What about the hard facts? What should you actually share when you are sending information to them? Start with what you know. You can converse about rights, laws, fetal development, types of abortion, post-abortion syndrome, miscarriage, premature babies, carcinogens. But at the same time, we have to humbly admit when we don't know something that we'll get back to them and provide them with more evidence and, yes, actually follow up. Even tell stories and allow the other person we're talking to tell their own stories of themselves and their friends who have been through these difficult issues that they've taken a stance on. Remember, I said this, many of the women marching this weekend at the Women's March will have gone through their own abortion, and they're carrying those wounds, and they have stories to tell. Will we be the soft landing place for them to share it? And remember, you have been chosen to be a part of these conversations. You're never alone. Ask Our Lady to be in the room, pray for the intercession of the other person's guardian angel, and implore the Holy Spirit to be in your mind, on your lips, and in your heart as you are called to engage in these conversations that are so important.